We'll get started then. We're on record in our business meeting of the Judicial Council of California for October 25th, 2012. Good afternoon. The meeting's now in session. As you know, this is the start of a two-day session. We will adjourn this afternoon at approximately 5:10 and reconvene tomorrow at 8:30 a.m. for the second part of our agenda. At this time, I remind Council, as always, that our meetings are audiocast live with real-time captioning on the California Courts website. So for the benefit of the online audience, please speak into your microphones and address each other by name so that listeners and real-time captioning readers can follow our discussion. Portions of these meetings are also routinely videotaped for a later broadcast on the California Courts website. Before we begin with our first order of business, which is the swearing in of our new Judicial Council members and the ceremonial swearing in of Judge Jarr as Administrator Director of the Courts and the new Secretary to the Council, I'd like to take a few moments before the oath to put the significance of the oaths you are about to take into some historical and practical context. You are all about to swear or affirm that you will support and defend and bear true faith and allegiance to the Constitution of the State of California. And it will be 86 years ago, as of Friday next, that Californians voted by a margin of more than 2-1 to create the Judicial Council. That year, the California voters' pamphlet regarding the creation of the Judicial Council observed that, quote, "One of the troubles with our court system is that the work of the various courts is not correlated, and nobody is responsible for seeing that the machinery of the courts is working smoothly. When it is discovered that some rule of procedure is not working well, it is nobody's business to see that the evil is corrected. But with a judicial council, whenever anything goes wrong, any judge or lawyer or litigant or other citizen will know to whom to make complaint, and it will be the duty of the council to propose a remedy. And if this cannot be done without an amendment to the laws, the council will recommend to the legislature any change in the law which it deems necessary," end quote. So you see, the council has a duty to the judges and to the courts, to the lawyers, and to the people of California whom we all serve. If there is a problem with the court system, then we must identify and fix it. If it requires legislation, then we must recommend it. Interestingly, that same 1926 voters pamphlet also noted that the amendment creating the Judicial Council had other things involved. It would also provide for a presiding judge of the Superior Court in every county. And that, quote, "This amendment will aid in greatly simplifying and improving the administration of justice," end quote. So these functions remain as important today as they were back then. Maybe I submit even more so given the complexity of the judicial branch. But in essence, in 1926, it was recognized that local courts provide access to justice and court services to their local communities, with the Judicial Council correlating, simplifying, and improving the administration of justice at the statewide level. And all of these efforts are in accord with the goal of increasing access to justice. So with the goal of equal access and the duty to correlate the courts in mind, the council will meet at least 12 times this year, with two special sessions, one a business and the other an educational informational session on the state budget. And including the items on today and tomorrow's agenda, the council will have considered 88 consent items, 62 discussion items, and 33 information-only agenda items of relevance to statewide administration of justice this year. Unfortunately, as you know, this year, quite a number of those information-only agenda items related to public notices by courts of court closures or reduced clerks' office hours due to the ongoing judicial branch cuts. Under the Judicial Council's public comment process, our agendas to date have stimulated 53 written pieces of comment, and 42 individuals have come before the council to speak on a matter affecting judicial administration or a specific agenda item. Comments have come from the judiciary, from justice system partners, from concerned members of the public throughout our state. It's healthy for our democracy and for the work of this council to seek and receive public comment on issues relating to our branch, their branch of government, and our judicial system, their judicial system. After all, it was in 1926 that the public created this body to serve their best interests, the public's best interest, for simplifying and improving the administration of justice. The first item, then, next on our agenda, is the swearing in of 12 members of the council beginning new terms. 9 are new members of the council, and 3 have been reappointed. Every year, as you know, about a third of council membership changes. This ensures continuity while creating opportunities for new participation for court leaders statewide. All council members volunteer their service on this governing body and its advisory committees and task forces. All members do not represent individual courts or individual geographic areas, but instead all of us make decisions in the best interests of the branch, of the court statewide, and of the public we serve. The new members have observed earlier council sessions, and all have received an orientation to council rules and procedures. I invite each of the new members to please stand at their seat for the oath. I'll mention the new members now. Judge James Brandlin, Superior Court of Los Angeles County. Presiding Judge Lori Earle, Superior Court of Sacramento County, as chair of the trial court budget at the trial presiding judge's working group, but she is not present with us today. Presiding Judge Cheryl Ellsworth, Superior Court of Riverside County. Mr. James Fox, State Bar appointee. Judge Alan Hardcastle, Superior Court of Sonoma County and current President of the California Judges Association. Judge Morris Jacobson, Superior Court of Alameda County. Presiding Judge Brian McCabe, Superior Court of Merced County. Judge Charles Walkup, Superior Court of Placer County. Ms. Mary Beth Todd, Court Executive Officer, Superior Court, Sutter County. Our 3 reappointed members are Judge David D'Alba, Superior Court of Sacramento County, Judge David Rosenberg, Superior Court of Yolo County, Judge Kenneth So, Superior Court of San Diego County. And last but not least, I would ask Judge Stephen Jarre to join us in the ceremonial swearing-in. He is the 5th Administrative Director of the Courts in California and Secretary to the Judicial Council. Please raise your right hand and repeat after me. I, state your name.
I, Brian
Rosenberg. Do solemnly swear or affirm.
Do solemnly swear or affirm.
That I will support and defend.
That I will support and defend.
The Constitution of the United States.
The Constitution of the United States.
And the Constitution of the State of California.
And the Constitution of the State of California.
Against all enemies, foreign and domestic.
Against all enemies, foreign and domestic.
That I will bear true faith and allegiance. To the Constitution of the United States. And the Constitution of the State of California. That I take this obligation freely. Without any mental reservation. Or purpose of evasion. And that I will well and faithfully
discharge the duties
upon which I'm about to enter. Many congratulations. Thank you for your time. At this time, it is my great pleasure to recognize 4 jurists, 4 outstanding judicial branch leaders for their years of hard work as chairs of respective advisory committees as they end their tenure. This is not goodbye. It's not farewell. It is so long. Justice Ming Chin, outgoing chair of the Court Technology Advisory Committee. Justice James Lamdin, outgoing chair of the Access and Fairness Committee. Justice Stephen Perrin, who joins us on the phone, outgoing chair of the Criminal Law Advisory Committee, and Justice Ron Roby, outgoing chair of the Governing Committee of the Center for Judicial Education and Research, who could not be with us today. I'd like to welcome, I know Justice Chin and Justice Lambden are present with us today. The Judicial Council's advisory committees are critical to the innovative policies and programs the Council is able to advance to benefit the statewide administration of justice. As many of you know, the Judicial Council couldn't move forward in improving the administration of justice without the essential contributions of the almost 400 judges, court administrators, lawyers, and other justice system stakeholders and experts who serve on our many advisory committees and task forces. We're fortunate to have the benefit of their legal expertise, their court experience, their volunteerism, and their passion for justice. I'd like to name a few accomplishments of these jurists here today as we say so long. Justice Ronald Roby is the longest-serving chair of the CJUR Governing Committee from November 2007 through November 2012. He has been a member of the Governing Committee since 2003. He became chair shortly after the education rules were implemented, and he has directly overseen their implementation throughout the branch. His steady and effective stewardship during the first three-year education period resulted in a positive evaluation of the education rules by the judiciary. During his tenure as chair, he has been an extremely strong advocate for the use of technology in distance education. As the budget crisis deepened, Justice Roby took the initiative to have CJUR leverage distance education to provide high-quality education as inexpensively as possible. His major legacy with regards to judicial education will probably be the implementation of a new education development model and the establishment of a recurring two-year branch-wide education plan. This model lays out a blueprint for education, provides transparency and accountability in the allocation of resources for these educational efforts, and enables leadership to more easily adapt to fiscal challenges while maintaining a high level of quality education. Over and above all of this, CJUR staff informs me, although this I know personally, that Justice Roby is congenial, cordial, funny, warm, and possesses an extremely penetrating intellect. They forgot to say that he has boundless energy. Justice Stephen Perrin, who joins us by phone, was first appointed as a member of the committee in 1995 and has served as chair of the Criminal Law Advisory Committee since 2001, a truly remarkable tenure. The work of the advisory committee is invaluable, not only in the review of pending legislation, but for overseeing the implementation of practical solutions to issues that routinely affect California's criminal justice system. Under Justice Perrin's stewardship, the committee has developed numerous recommendations integral to the statewide administration of criminal proceedings, including rules of court to govern venue, habeas corpus, and inter-county probation transfer procedures. Most recently, Justice Perrin has been at the forefront of the arrival of criminal justice realignment, an unprecedented restructuring of the criminal justice system. The Criminal Law Advisory Committee has been extremely busy this past year. Justice Perrin is leaving after his committee has done some of his most important work. The committee has developed several key recommendations to help the branch brace for the transition of parole revocations from state executive branch to courts, including a rule of court to govern revocation proceedings for a new category of parole supervision called post-release community supervision. The rule represented an entirely new procedure built from scratch. It was critical to facilitating the first wave of parole transition to courts last year. And he also, with the committee, pioneered a legislative proposal to apply longstanding probation revocation procedures to the three new categories of post-realignment supervision. Those are post-release community supervision, mandatory supervision, and parole, beginning in July 2013. And he accomplished all of this during the most challenging fiscal climate the branch has ever faced. Justice James Lambden, who's present, and I ask you to stand, sir. He is the outgoing chair of the Judicial Council's Access and Fairness Advisory Committee. He has chaired the advisory committee for the last 9 years and has served on the committee since 2001. Justice Lamdin has been the ideal judge to chair this committee because of his firm belief in actions and collaboration with all segments of the branch and its partners in the legal community on initiatives relating to access and fairness. Some of the key accomplishments for the Access and Fairness Advisory Committee under his stewardship as chair include ensuring that court users with disabilities have physical and programmatic access to the courts by making necessary revisions to Rule of Court 1.100 and providing resources to bench officers to assist them in responding to requests for accommodations, ensuring completion of the implementation of the recommendations in the Council's gender bias study, collaborating with CEJR in convening the first ever statewide conference on language access, creating a pilot mentoring program for court staff that is currently going on in 4 Bay Area trial courts, providing guidance to the trial courts on ways to attain diversity in the appointment of temporary judges by proposing and council adopting rules 10.741 and 10.743, developing a rule of court that assists courts in tracking the diversity of their civil grand juries and providing resources to the courts that demonstrate ways to achieve representative civil grand juries, creating judicial resources that provide guidance to bench officers on issues that might arise with LGBT court users, and finally, involving the Judicial Council in 2 summits on judicial diversity. And he will be presenting on the 2011 summit in agenda item number 1 in our meeting later today. Thank you, Justice Lamdin. For the last 10 years, where's Justice Chin? Please stand, Justice Chin. For the Court Technology Advisory Committee, Justice Ming Chin has chaired this committee and has been a dedicated champion for the advancement of information technology to improve court practices and to improve access to every level of the courts for all Californians. He has extensive knowledge of and interest in technology and how it can be applied to the work of the courts. And he still has a desire to pay his traffic tickets on his smartphone. His legacy is that he helped shape the future of information technology in our branch. And I'll highlight only a few of his and CTAC's accomplishments. Statewide Administrative Infrastructure Directive. In 2003, Judicial Council adopted CTAC's recommendation to establish a statewide administrative infrastructure. This has led to a branch technology center, upgraded telecommunication networks, and a single accounting system. The California Courts Protective Order Registry, CCPOR. This gives judicial officers access to time-sensitive information about restraining and protective orders active across the state, and that same information is shared with other judicial officers and law enforcement to help a protected person and to keep people safe. E-citations, as I have said, for whatever reason of particular interest to Justice Chin, is the implementation of e-citation as it interfaces between law enforcement and the courts. Today, several courts host local interfaces with law enforcement agents, including the Highway Patrol, in order to electronically issue, transmit, and resolve citations online, only once printing out the ticket at the time of issuance. I hope, Justice Chin, you don't get to test that system too regularly. Thank you. We thank all of you for your service to the Judicial Council and the people of California in your leadership roles. We recognize also that we're fortunate to have all of you still continue on the bench with the benefit of your service, as well as in the many other capacities you continue to serve the people of California. We're grateful for your leadership. We are better for it, and you have inspired others by your exemplary role in the branch. You deserve more, but today we give you a round of applause. And Justice Perrin, you might have missed it, but you just received a standing ovation.
As a thespian, I can assure you it is deeply appreciated.
Thank you again.
Thank you, Chief.
Next on our agenda, we have public comment. Although we have 11 overall requests for public comment at this meeting, we have four for today's general comments and consent agenda-related items. The remaining speakers will be reserved for tomorrow to discuss separate agenda items, namely, as far as I know, item I on tomorrow's agenda. As you know, we generally reserve this time for public comment about consent agenda items or matters generally affecting the administration of justice. Also, written comments are included in your council member materials. Those written comments are also posted on the Judicial Council meetings page on the California Courts website, and I believe you may have, there might be some distribution of those matters today as well. I'd like to invite now to the podium, first, Ms. Mary Lou Aranguren. Welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chief Justice and Council members. Thanks for the opportunity to speak today. I'm standing in for a spokesperson for the California Federation of Interpreters who could not be here at the last minute. So bear with me as I'm reading the comments. Chief Justice and members of the Council, thank you very much for the opportunity to address you on behalf of the California Federation of Interpreters. I'm here to talk to you about one specific but pressing issue that you should be aware of, the Domestic Violence Family Law Interpreter Program, and how confusion about this program is causing courts to needlessly deny interpreter services to victims of domestic violence. The Domestic Violence Family Law Interpreter Program is a grant-funded program that reimburses courts for costs related to providing certified interpreters to domestic violence-related hearings and services. Earlier this year, the courts were informed that the funding to this program would be exhausted, and courts would not be reimbursed from this grant for the remainder of the year. At least some courts responded to this news by announcing that interpreters would no longer be made available to domestic violence-related civil hearings. This means that victims of domestic violence who come to the court to seek restraining orders against their abusers are effectively denied access to the courts for these hearings and related issues such as child custody, visitation, and support. Obviously, this is a serious problem. This program has been found to be a complete success, both for the courts and court users. The report on the program from last year stated, "Feedback from participating courts indicates that the program has been extremely helpful in improving access to California's justice system, enhancing safety for domestic violence victims and children, and improving court efficiency by reducing the need for continuances and court hearings due to lack of interpreters, or continuances of court hearings due to lack of interpreters. The problem is not that this funding is exhausted, however. The real problem here is the misunderstanding that courts have about this fund and about the interpreter fund in general. In fact, there is nothing unusual this year about the DV Family Fund being exhausted. The fund is exhausted every year, and courts can continue and have continued to provide interpreters to these hearings and receive full reimbursements from the court interpreter budget item in the trial court trust fund. Last year, the report on this program stated, "The AOC Center for Families, Children, and the Courts has been operating this program for a number of years and typically receives requests for funding that are at least twice as much as the funding available in the grant fund." This means that, in fact, courts were providing interpreters beyond what is covered by the grant and were reimbursed out of the interpreter budget item rather than the family law interpreter program. And we know that the interpreter budget item was not exhausted. In fact, the interpreter funding item has run a surplus year after year that this council has established should remain in a reserve available for courts for ongoing interpreter costs. Nothing in the budget bill prevents the use of interpreter funding for DV or any other civil matters. Yet the basis for restricting interpreter services has essentially been that there is a shortfall of funds. However, this is clearly incorrect. Because courts wrongly believe that funding isn't available, independent interpreters are being told that they will not be hired for domestic violence hearings, and employee staff interpreters are told that they are not to interpret for non-criminal hearings, even when the interpreters are present and available to interpret in these hearings at no additional cost to the court. Some courts are still refusing to provide interpreter services in these cases, and there are occasions when interpreters are literally in the courtroom standing by and are told to let parties go ahead with their case without an interpreter or to have their case continued. The SEC report at page 99, recommendation 7-12, states, internally, the finance division should not act as an impediment in the delivery of interpreter services to the courts. We do not know what the background is for this recommendation. However, we are aware from our own experience that there has been and continues to be confusion at the trial courts about what services are eligible for reimbursement from the interpreter budget item. We urge that this situation be clarified and addressed so that victims of domestic violence do not pay the price by being unnecessarily denied access to the courts. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Next, I understand three people will be sharing 10 minutes. The three people, I understand, are Ms. Barbara Kaufman, Mr. Alan Ernesto, and Ms. Yupa Asawasuksant.
Good afternoon, Chief Justice and Judicial Council members. My name is Barbara Kaufman, and I'm a family law attorney. I was formerly based in Marin County, but have now moved to Mount Shasta, which many refer to as God's country. And I now practice in your stomping grounds, Judge Jarre. I submitted a written comment regarding information item 3, addressing the Family Court Mediation Working Files Report prepared by the Family and Juvenile Law Advisory Committee. Time is short, and I did prepare a lengthy written comment, and I hope you do read that, and I also hope you do read Emily Gallup's written comment. She is a former mediator from Nevada County. I am here to speak very briefly about the mediation files issue as well. First, I would like to be very clear to the council that I do not believe that family court services mediators should be making custody recommendations at all. Mediation can be an extraordinarily positive experience when the focus is on helping parents resolve issues and voluntarily come to a custody plan. That is no longer the goal when the mediator has 1 or 2 hours only to assess two parents going through a terrible, terrible time in their lives, facing complex custody issues. Suddenly, that mediator's goal is to assess these two parents and try in 2 hours to assess which parent is going to be the best parent. If a family went to a private therapist and said, look, we have 1 or 2 hours, please do this for us, the therapist would say, no offense, are you crazy? I can't make a custody recommendation in 1 or 2 hours. If a family came to a lawyer and said, here are our issues and blended families and multiple children and multiple parental partners, please figure this out, and he drinks and she does this, a lawyer would throw up their hands and say, 1 or 2 hours, I can't do that. A judge can't do it. That's why there are multiple days of trial often. But family court mediators are told that they are to do this, and that is what they do, and that is what parents are facing when they go through family court mediation, recommending mediation. As a litigator, and that is what I do, I am stunned at the report that you have been presented. I am stunned at the cavalier and haphazard way that this committee is proposing that what is actually child custody evidence be treated, that 58 counties can decide what to do with that information, and that decision can be made by an individual mediator, by a director. It could be made by anybody. So, for example, you are all very familiar with courtroom and with litigation. If there's a note in the mediation file that says, the child reported, handwritten note, the child reported that dad hits me, sometimes for fun and sometimes he means it. And we know from the history of the case that that child has come home with unexplained bruises. I, as a litigator, when I have to challenge a recommendation saying, put this child with the father, I want to see that note. That is what I look for. So I can say, Your Honor, this recommendation is wrong. Why isn't this report of this child that father hits him in that recommendation? That is how I do my job. That is what parents need. And it is unfathomable to think that that note could be destroyed before that report is presented to the court, and that is actually what this report is suggesting. That note should remain in that file for the majority, until the child reaches the age of majority, because in contested custody cases, parents come back. The child changes. The needs of the child changes. It provides a context for the mediators to understand what is going on in a family, and it provides the ability of parents, I see the sign, of parents and of lawyers to properly present the case to the court. This is child custody evidence and it should not be destroyed. The council is tasked with creating, by the Constitution and statutorily in the Family Code, and I put this in my written comment, it's tasked with creating administrative procedures and processes that are uniform, and that is what has to happen with child custody evidence. It's too important. The safety of a child, the due process of a parent to be able to question properly a custody recommendation made in by a stranger within an hour, perhaps recommending that a parent only get supervised visitation. None of you would want to be in that position. You would all want access to that note that would show the judge what is really happening. I ask you to step up, please, and protect the families, and protect the children, and protect the due process rights of the parents, and also protect the mediators who have an impossible task of having only 1 or 2 hours to make a recommendation. They need those notes to understand what has gone on in a case. Please step up. Please make sure that the child custody evidence in the working files are kept throughout the age of majority for the youngest child. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Kaufman. Mr. Ernesto? Okay. I'm sorry, Mr. Phillips. Thank you, Mr. Allen Ernesto Phillips.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chief Justice. Esteemed honorable members of the council, thank you for having me here today. As a layperson, I'm going to apologize in advance for that. My name is Allen Ernesto Phillips. I reside in Shasta County. I currently serve as the elected chairman to the Board of Directors for the Northern California Hispanic Latino Coalition, and we serve 7 North State counties. It may be noteworthy that I've also served our great state for the past 13 years as a parenting educator to mainstream, at-risk, and court-mandated parents. I served the Shasta County Juvenile Justice Center for 7 years as an at-risk and first-time offender group counselor. I have served the Shasta Interagency Narcotics Task Force with distinction that earned me a commendation from the State Attorney General for my work in 2005, educating California's Latino parents on how to combat Latino gang and drug activities. But more important than all the other accolades related to my contributions, I've been an even better loving father and dad of a now 16-year-old daughter, River Brewster Phillips, who was abducted 594 days ago with no contact allowed, and is a loving, committed father to my wonderful 10-year-old daughter, Ileana Phillips, who is excelling in school and primarily lives with me. In my many years of professional service, I've also found myself lost in the bigness of the family law system. Under questionable practices of arrogant, intimidating mediators, a mentally questionable 19-year veteran, retired, assigned judge, if you're still following me, and as well, I find as bureau dumping of my respectful, properly filed complaints within the previous AOC. Issues, I contend, that are related to the importance of retaining records and notes by family court mediators. Now, Don't get me wrong, I'm grateful for this opportunity, and I'm speaking in support of retaining records and notes until a child reaches majority. As an outspoken and published court reform advocate for several years, I wish to go on the record today by thanking the Honorable Stephen Baker, whose neutrality and child-focused decisions were originally meant to help my oldest daughter, River. I wish to also commend the Honorable Stephen Jarre for his child-focused handling of a family law matter that was originally meant to help my youngest daughter, Ileana. I wanted to look you in the eyes today. Judge Baker, I'm sorry.
Over here.
I apologize. There you are. I just wanted to look at you in the eyes today and express my deepest gratitude for the service that you provided and attempted to provide for my daughters. So I don't want to come off as somebody who hates all judges and that sort of thing. I'm grateful. Thank you, sirs. When my oldest daughter, River, was removed from our family on March 17, 2011, after a frightening 20-minute so-called mediation triage in a dark courthouse hallway, and after a subsequent 5-minute nightmare ruling under a retired rogue judge and sadistic mediator executive director, our family world was turned upside down as my daughter was removed from us without any contact allowed. There was no regard for the careful controls set up by Judge Baker. No access to previous mediation records that could clearly evidence our daughter River had a very long history of failing and truancy under her mother's care. There were no charges of neglect, no charges of abuse. Just a unilateral cursory examination, another quickie 17-minute so-called formal mediation, and the court chose to rule on opinions of court appointees rather than even reading the clear and convincing contrary evidences that I properly filed and prepared, all in clear disregard for the CRCs for mediators and therapists under 5.210. As a direct outcome, our daughter River went from a consistent honor roll student in a 50-50 shared custody arrangement instantly down to a truant, failing, at-risk youth. And she stays consistently in that preventable outcome to this day. When it comes to the lives of children, proper records can be a powerful ally in keeping litigants and court professionals on an even ethical playing field while protecting due process and sustaining the healthiest decisions for our children. I've asserted and proven in declaration after declaration for years that an irregular Shasta County mediator, executive director, and a mentally failing retired assigned judge are without oversight and select their own facts. I believe in a systematic retaliation that I do not have time to go into at this point. To date, there are neither protections nor remedy for the harm that has befallen my children by these prejudging officers of the court. But I thank God for certified court reporters. If an irregular mediator or supervisor chooses to make a life-altering recommendation to the court only to choose destruction of the supporting documents thereafter, due process and the possibility to right wrongdoing and errors will be lost. The selective destruction of a rich history of information, possibly helpful for other children of unfortunate circumstances, disappears. I'm going to close as I see the hook. In closing, it is probably too late now to help my oldest daughter, River, out of an at-risk downward spiral as she goes into the passageway of adulthood. It is probably too late for critical sibling bonding to take place between my beloved daughters. There has been no permanence in our lives for years. It seems to me this committee has had 2 years to decide not to decide anything in this matter before the council. As a lay taxpayer, I'm kind of troubled by that thought. And as a heartbroken father of an illegally abducted daughter, I'm outraged and appear today as a mere indicator species of sorts. I used to believe in the chance at justice for my children, but your court-appointed mediators, retired judges, court-appointed therapists, court-appointed GALs, previous AOC, I should say, and inept clerks, some of them, have all attacked my kids, bringing them lasting harm. And you can always bank on my civility, as heartbroken as I am. But I wonder what you would do if you were in my situation. But to conclude, it is not too late to take action today. In the depths of my despair, I urgently request this powerful group of greater minds to take real steps in abolishing, recommending mediation as a requirement of the family law process. It fails too many kids when they have too much power in selecting their own facts to retaliate and destroy evidence. If you truly want to save funds, abolish the assigned judges program as it is. In the least, I respectfully urge that you expeditiously enact uniform practices of mediation records and retention until majority. I'm not just an afterthought here, ladies and gentlemen. I'm a primary stakeholder. And I stand with my fellow protective parents. And my children will thank you someday. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Phillips.
Good afternoon, Chief Justice and Honorable. Thank you for having me today to give my testimony. Please bear with me. I'm come from Thailand, and I, you know, try to express my concern, reasonable concern, in another language. My name is Yupa Asawasuksan from Thailand. I am a registered nurse who received 2 Academy Awards from the medical school. I received the Daisy Pin for being an extraordinary nurse at Kaiser. I am also a divorced mother of a 15-year-old boy, and I have been through Marine Family Court for the past over 12 years. I am asking you today, please make sure the mediation working files are not destroyed. Please listen to my story from my heart to yours. Please imagine if you have a medical problem and your doctor destroy all your medical history when your medical exam is pending. It would be a crime, wouldn't be? My son came home from an explanation private genital, inflamed private genital, and nobody know why. My ex-husband would claim that he put something at my son's private genital. My son came home and talking about pornography that he was seeing at his father's house. My son was exposed to the violent bloody video game at his father at age of 6 years old. In 2006, while we were taking our son to the doctor appointment, the father was whispered to our minor son that I'm going to be killed or died. My son told the police and told the judge in court. My request for a restraining order was denied. We went through 2 custody trials in 2005 and 2007. I documented everything in my pleading. I was forced to go to the mediation with the court mediator, Gloria Wu. During her first interview with my minor son, my son told her his father was hitting him. She did not include in her report to the court. We found that in her handwritten notes that my son had informed her that his father was hitting him. She also testified during cross-examination that she did not read the court file or any of my pleading, not one. I won that trial with the 26 days a month with my sons. Then Judge Verna Adam came into the family bench in 2007. My ex-husband filed another custody motion. I asked for a different mediator. my request was denied. I challenged her. Dr. Wu sent another recommendation that I lost all the custody of my minor sons and placed me on 2-hour super visitation per week. No holiday, no vacation, and the father did not ask any of that. During the second trial, she testified again. Dr. Wu testified again. During cross-examination, she did not read the file, but she read all the father pleading. She testified during cross-examination, she did not know the local rule and the state law. Even follow the court mediation proceeding and procedure. I document everything. I got all the transcript and I present all my information transcript to the legislature in support of the state audit of Marin Family Courts, which is include my son pictures of unexplained bruises as big as a fist size, medical report, dental report, school report cards, and especially the note that the court mediator, a handwritten note that my son was telling her that his father hitting him, and all were destroyed before the audit could take place. Anyway, I just would like to say this before I go, that we need the court reporter and the video in the courtroom to prevent retaliation by the judge and organized crime by the court mediator. Thank you for having me today.
I thank all the speakers who came to share their public comment today. Thank you.